You are listening to The Pulse, Rod Murray's e-learning tech podcast. Number
164, Future of Education, panel with Brian Alexander. Hi, this is Rod Murray. Welcome back to my podcast. Well, that little piece was a clip from a song that was created by artificial intelligence. It's called Utopian Prince, and it's from Juke Deck. You can create your own futuristic AI music at Juke Deck. Give it a try. This podcast is sponsored by Inside Higher Ed, the online source for news, opinion, and jobs for all of higher education. I also invite you to follow me on Twitter. My handle is RodsPods. As always, I post links to all the things we talk about on my show notes at www.rodspulsepodcast.com. This special podcast is a broadcast of a panel discussion at the University of the Sciences eLearning 3.0 conference that was held on Thursday, March 8th at the University of the Sciences in Philadelphia. The excellent moderator for the panel was Dr. Brian Alexander, who was also our keynote speaker. You can listen to his keynote speech on Rod's Pulse podcast, number 163. We are very happy to have some very distinguished panelists. I'll save the full introductions for the actual broadcast of the panel. We answer the questions, how will students differ in 2030? How will faculty differ in 2030? Where do you see educational entrepreneurships having the greatest impact in the future? Which educational trends keep you up at night? And a lot of other questions. Brian did such an excellent job in moderating the panel, and we also took some questions from the audience. I think you'll find it enlightening and entertaining. I kicked off the panel discussion by showing a brief video on one possible future education scenario. Incidentally, if you are listening to this in your car or just by audio, note there is also a video podcast with the slides and video from the panel. So you may want to pause and wait till you get in front of your computer or can watch a video on YouTube. So without further ado, here's the rebroadcast of the panel discussion on the future of education. Okay, folks, welcome. Welcome back to our second general session. We have our panel all seated here. I'm going to give some brief introductions, and then we'll get on with the I want to leave plenty of time for discussion and questions. So first, you've already met Dr. Alexander here, and I have to ask him, you can't see the screen. Is that your DeLorean you're sitting in?
Yes. Not currently.
So those of you who didn't make the keynote, Dr. Alexander is a futurist, writer, teacher, speaker, and he's the founder of Brian Alexander Consulting. And he does a weekly live panel discussion called Future Trends, the Future Trends Forum. So I encourage you to take a look at that. We have Dr. Bobby Baggio, who gave a great presentation already this morning on chatbots. And you can see her credentials here. She's currently Associate Provost at Cedar Crest College in Allentown. And we have Dr. Ken Hartman, CEO of DegreeQuest, and many of you probably know him as the former president of Drexel University Online, for-profit subsidiary of Drexel University. And Dr. Paul Katz, I'm happy to say our president, has joined our panel today. He was the founding, before he came to U-Sciences, he was the founding dean of Cooper Medical School, Rowan University, and before that, vice dean for faculty and clinical affairs at the Commonwealth Medical School in Scranton. And then there's yours truly here. I'll be sitting on the panel. What I want to do, sort of to kick off the scene here, is to play a five-minute video. It's a scenario of what the future of education might be like.
The future is already here. It's just not evenly distributed. This scenario illustrates one future of education. Technology is increasing at an exponential rate. The interesting thing about the scenario is that each of the technologies illustrated here exist today in isolation. Who knows where we'll actually be in 5 to 10 years? Meet our new traditional student, Martina Lopez, a 30-year-old employed mother, a member of Generation Z. the first in her family to graduate from college. Women made up the majority of her graduating class. This is 2025. She and her peers are the core of our workforce. Martina was just awakened by her Ring doorbell app on her Facebook phone. Who knows what the new mobile devices will look like? After all, the iPhone is over 10 years old. She sees the package on her doorstep through the Ring doorbell app. The Amazon UPS robotic drone had just dropped off a small package containing a tablet for her new course. Her world is all about mobility, convenience, and free education. The Apple Gucci tablet contains the syllabus, all the electronic textbooks, apps, and links to all of the free open access online resources she will need to take an online course from MIT Intel. The course is free for her because her employer wants her to study the latest on robotics algorithms used in the rapidly changing pharmaceutical industry. She only comes to the office when she needs to work with prototype robot hardware. Having no fixed semesters allows Martina to customize her learning path along the way using MOOC badges, Coursera verified certificates like this one from University of London, even some nano degrees that she does on her own time. Fortunately, badges, certificates, and diplomas are now authenticated using blockchain technology. There's no need to ask for a diploma from multiple institutions. In fact, MIT Media Lab rolled out BlockCerts recently. That's an open infrastructure for academic credentials. She authenticates on her tablet using biometrics to satisfy the accreditors. The camera on the tablet recognizes her face, so she doesn't have to remember a password to log in. Strong multi-factor authentication is as easy as taking a selfie. In fact, USciences already uses keystroke biometrics for authenticating our own online students. Martina doesn't own a car, so she summons a GM Lyft self-driving car. She gets in the back seat and listens to her new syllabus while the car drives her to work 2 hours away. Of course, Lyft stopped at the Starbucks drive-thru for her scheduled caffeine fix. 15 minutes into her two-hour ride, Martina's watch alerts her to a video office hours appointment with her Japanese AI professor. She talks with her prof in real time on her tablet using her wireless Apple AirPods. No matter that he was in Tokyo and spoke in Japanese, she saw an almost simultaneous Google translation in text and heard English. She answered in English and he nodded. Her voice was translated to Japanese just as fast, as is shown in this actual example of the new fast Google Translator.
Professor, what course do you think I should take next?
教授は、あなたが私が次に取るべきだと思います。
That's a real-time example using AI machine learning instead of algorithmic translation. He helped Martina tweak the code in the laboratory AR simulation that allowed her to feel when she pushed a button or dialed a knob in mid-air. Ultra Haptics uses ultrasound to add touch in these augmented reality simulation apps. Finally, Martina is able to test the AR simulation using her prescription Google Luxottica AR glasses. Martina accomplished a lot before arriving at her office to start her day job. At her desk, she would finish converting the AR simulated device into a 3D design of this custom part, and she prints the custom part at her desk using her phone. In fact, as we speak, I'm waiting for my own $99 Olo Smart 3D printer. Using that 3D printed part, it completes the custom lifelike robot.
I can be a good partner to humans in these areas, an ambassador who helps humans to smoothly integrate and make the most of all the new technological tools and possibilities that are available now.
A customized Toshiba customer service pharmacy tech robot for her employer's client, CVS Walgreens. Martina has excelled as the assistant director of robotics research at her employer, Pfizer Medtronic.
So,
Here's your first question to the panel. I'm going to sit down and let Brian take over the moderation.
So, welcome back from lunch, everybody. This is the most difficult point of the day. After you've had a lovely lunch and great conversation and glanced at the day outside, now you're here digesting, entering the glide path towards somnolence. So we have to fight to make sure you're conscious. And as part of that campaign, we have some excellent questions. So one question I'd like to deliver to the panel is, how will students differ in 2030 from where you see them now in 2018?
Well, I'll start. There's another question about what keeps us up at night. And this is one of the things that keeps me up at night. And there are a lot of reasons for that. I think one of the things is that the number of college-age students in this country is declining pretty dramatically. And we're in the state of Pennsylvania, we're not going to see last year's levels of high school grads until 2025. So we've got a big downturn here. And there's a change within that demographic, too. There are decline in African-American college-age students, decline in Caucasian college-age students. And so I think that's the reality of what's one of the things that concerns us. I think the idea of what a student is going to change from its undergraduate focus to graduate focus to lifelong learning and to people who are learning in, from college or whatever eventually is the subsequent version of college throughout their careers. And I think it's going to be about continuing to build competencies and continuing to take on new skills. There's been a lot of discussion about higher ed under duress, and there's no question higher ed is under duress for lots of reasons. And one of the reasons it's under duress is because higher ed typically lags far behind the rest of the world in terms of how it responds to market forces, and so that's one of the things that we're trying to deal with now. So I think the kind of things you have to think about is that we're going to move from a largely brick-and-mortar world to a world that's much more electronic. It's going to be a lot more interactive. It's going to be students, by whatever the broad definition of that of a student is, picking from an array, a menu of different things that they can pick up, maybe something from U-Sciences, maybe something from Penn, maybe something from Cal Berkeley, maybe something from industry, and developing a portfolio of skills and competencies that they will continue to build on. So I think the shifts that we're going to see in the next 12 years are going to be monumental. If you think back 12 years to where things were to now and thinking that the pace of those changes is going to accelerate, I think it's going to be a world that's far, far different than what we can even imagine now.
Thinking of 2006 before the financial crash, right?
Absolutely.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Please.
I'd like to say what I think and what I hope, if I can break it down into two categories. I think Rod kind of alluded to it up there. We're going to clearly see quantum computing a reality. And with that, I believe that AI will be just an overwhelming force. And I think most kids, from the time that they're in middle school through perhaps graduate school, will have their own AI advisor that will take them through almost every decision, from not just what course to take, what instructor to take, when to take your quizzes and so forth, what readings to do, where, because that AI will know them, because as you, they've been talking to Alexa since they've been 5 years old. So all that information has been recorded. What I hope, this is the same hope I had 20 years ago when I published my first book on the internet in college education, that Brad did a really nice interview with me a few months ago on the 20th anniversary of it. And 20 years ago when I published my first book and on the internet in higher ed, I made all sorts of predictions about how it was going to fundamentally transform the way students learn, teachers teach. I, for one, really disappointingly have not seen that. I think historians will look back at least this generation right now, and I've got a 26-year-old and a 23-year-old, and scratch their head and say, with all the information that they had at their disposal on their phone, how did we not have a more enlightened, intelligent conversation, more learning? So I'm hoping that we'll see more learning and better teaching in that year. But that's my hope.
It's hope rather than prediction.
Hi, please.
I think learners will always be learners. I think what's going to change is the expectations of the learners. I think you can see it now. You know, you can see little three-year-olds swiping their parents' iPhones. You can see it with this generation that's come up that's always been online, that's connected, who's always had LMSs as part. Now, the next one is going to be they're always going to have Alexa, or they're going to have Hey Google, or they're going to have some sort of an AI companion that goes along with it. I think our challenge is to keep up with those expectations, not to fight the technology, not to try to turn the clock back, but to understand that we as educators have to move towards keeping humans, I agree with Jack Ma on this, keeping humans good at what humans are good at and allowing computers to do what computers are good at. So we have to get past the level of memorization, knowledge-based, comprehension-based, and start out with application and move towards critical thinking and then the softer skills, those kinds of things that make us different than machines.
Bobby, do you think students in 2030 would be more likely to define themselves against automation as part of their identity?
I don't think so. I think that automation will be so much a part of their identity and a part of their world that it won't be an us and them kind of thing. It will just be, this is the environment that I live in, that I grow in, and that I learn in. Yeah. I do think those expectations of learning and what it takes to learn are going to be very, very different. And I think we as educators have to get on board with moving with those expectations.
I'm sorry, did everyone hear my question? I spoke off to one side, maybe missed the mic. I asked if students would define themselves against technology. I wasn't sure if you guys all heard that. But I know you heard the answer.
Is the wireless mic on?
No, but I've got this. Yeah, this isn't. This is a fascinating array of answers. Looking at change demographics, looking at students thinking in terms of competencies, looking at them working closely with AI and automation. Paul, do you think students are more likely to be picking and choosing from multiple providers than they are now?
I do. I think, you know, one of the things we've been talking about on our campus is what the expectations of Gen Z are, because they're much different than the millennials and those. And I think woe unto those who fail to recognize the changes and what their expectations are. So I think that's going to happen. There are already questions in higher ed. Why do I need to take a phys ed course if it's not really essential to me becoming a pharmacist?
Interesting.
You know, those kind of things. So what do I need to pursue the career goals that I have? And I think that's going to happen. I think it's happening already. And I think that higher ed, probably with perhaps the exception of a few ultra-elite institutions that may distinguish themselves on other basis, I think everybody's going to have to move to this. And, you know, there's a great book I read a couple of years ago talking about the end of college. It talks about the University of Everywhere. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's going to be a much different environment, and students are going to pick and choose off the best in class. They do that now. You know, I'll just tell a quick story. At the med school in Cooper, our students, when they were working on kidney physiology, would go to the University of Michigan and look at the University of Michigan syllabus and coursework because that was the best in class.
Yeah.
And so that's already happening. I think it's going to become more formalized, particularly since we now have a group of students and parents who are extremely cost conscious right now.
That seems likely to continue. thank you. If I can link back to Paul, do you think, would you imagine the students having AI tutors that help them with this process? So, okay, young Sue, you'd like to study more about anatomy. Well, we have all these wonderful resources online for you to pick and choose from. And then those AIs might cut across the grain of institutional priorities.
Go ahead.
No, I wasn't sure you're directed at it. The answer is, yeah. I mean, again, the computational abilities that will exist in 12, 15 years since we can only imagine this point in time.
That's what we have to do now. Thank you. I have one more question for people, but I want to ask, have you had a chance to answer this on Glisser? So you all cut loose and ignored our panel completely. This is great. But you also echo some of our panel's discussions. So we have echoing the president here about the students being older and taking classes in a variety of sources again. Interesting, we won't be seeking four-year degrees. That's interesting. We should go back to the nano degree and competency-based model. And they're just not going to take it. Now I'm hearing the music. I'm sorry, I can't get that out of my head. We'll need to be able to show value in what we offer. That may get ahead to another question. Thank you. Please, now that you've seen this, don't be shy. And we also have a Glisser support person and a full-time evangelist sitting about 6 feet in front of me. So we can take advantage. Is it Bill or Ben? I'm sorry.
Ben.
Very good. Very good. One last question for you, Bobby, as part of this, and then we can move on. Do you think, not what you hope, but do you think it's likely that instructors, K through 12, undergrad, grads, will they actually have changed by 2030? Or will there be a gap between technologically expectant, as you said, students, and less technologically fluent faculty?
It's hard to say that there will never be a gap. I mean, as long as there are age difference and technology is moving at the rate or faster that it's moving, there may be a gap. I think there will be less of a gap because I think we will have crossed the chasm. Mm-hmm. We are living through a period of time now where we went through huge changes. We went from a face-to-face environment that for the last 3, 500, whatever, 2,000 years, the way education was delivered was people circled around, somebody did a lecture, and that's how you got the information from an expert. The internet changed all that. You had a different way. Space came out of it, time came out of it, and where you went for expertise changed. So I think that, you know, there will always be a gap. I think it will be much more integrated. I think the challenges to get there, some of it is mentality on the faculty's part.
Yeah.
Some of it is mentality on the institution's part and the governance of those institutions.
Right.
Most of higher ed functions on the Harvard model, which is over 300 years old, which was great for the time that it was great for. But it's, you know, I think that we can already see so many success stories where technology and curriculum is being delivered and being delivered effectively in K-12 all around the world, where projects like Pencils for Promise, I don't know if you're familiar with them or not, the curriculum, they're one-room school houses, the curriculum goes in on a computer, and they get kids who are illiterate to 7th and 8th grade reading levels in under a year. What they don't have to fight that we have to fight in Philadelphia and New York and the United States is a structure of a K-12 institutions that are not really open to a lot of this technical integration. So will there not be a gap? I wouldn't say that there won't be a gap. I will say that the gap will be different. And the technology is going to be part of everything we do in education.
I think that faculty are probably one of the last professions to be totally replaced by AI robots. I mean, we'll be augmented, but, you know, that psychologists, psychiatrists, teachers, I think, so we'll have a job for some time.
And I think that goes back to what's the mission of higher education. Part of the mission is the creation of new knowledge.
Yeah, absolutely.
And if you look at where the innovation is coming, even with the technologies, like my little Jibo robot that I showed from MIT, those innovations are coming out of higher ed. They're not coming out of Silicon Valley. You know, higher ed is still the area that's pushing the envelope asking the hard questions.
But we'll also be using AI deeply in that research.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Oh, this is a good bridge. Thank you, Bobby. This is a good bridge to a second question, which is to ask, let's see if I
just hit the arrow. There you go.
Well, that was easy. Where do you see educational entrepreneurship having the greatest impact? So let's introduce entrepreneurship into that mix. And who wants to tackle that first? We may have an educational entrepreneur to answer that question.
I guess I'll take a shot at that. I think I've had the real pleasure of serving on a lot of EdTech business plan competitions, including the one at Miami Mater at Penn, where I've seen a lot of fascinating young entrepreneurs who have come up with some really great products and services to improve teaching and learning. The problem is it gets back to the structure, and it's difficult for these entrepreneurs to get into college campuses right. Because there's the in some places the attitude that, well, we already have what we need. Thank you very much. Charlie's got that spreadsheet over here. We don't need anything else. But I think that wall is coming down in a lot of institutions, and I think there's going to be ample opportunity for in areas like data analytics. Being able to demonstrate higher quality, higher learning at a lower cost. I think ultimately at the end of the day for college president, senior minister, can you do it better? Can you do it cheaper? I want to talk to you. That may not necessarily have been the case in years prior. There hasn't been that internal pressure as we have. And I also think going back to what I said earlier, I really do believe that the data that these companies are collecting on our kids is going to ultimately be turned into an AI advisor. And I think there are a lot of opportunities there, both good and bad, quite frankly, when it comes to data, collecting data, data privacy issues, and ensuring to college universities that the information that's being collected on these kids is not being put to bad as opposed to good. Right. So, but clearly data analytics right now I think is a huge area in both in the classroom and outside the classroom for entrepreneurs.
You know, this is a great time to give a plug to two of our sponsors who are both entrepreneurs that came out of Drexel University, APHIS and Practice. So what, they didn't come from Silicon Valley. They came from Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm. Which makes them tougher, I think.
Yeah. Definitely more resilient.
So and possibly colder. But thank you to both for helping sponsor this event. That's a fantastic answer, Ken. Thank you.
Well, and again, you see more and more colleges. Interesting. Colleges are creating their own incubators right. and funding these incubators, trying to give early seed funding to very smart students and faculty to push the limits. And ideally, they would like to monetize that in many cases. Many years ago, they realized, I think it was Stanford, realized how much they lost out on Google by not doing that. So I think that's a great opportunity for college leaders to begin looking at how can they take their own dollars or looking for outside funding. I met a gentleman today from Canada who's here, who their institution is doing that. It's a joint venture with the private entity to fund new and exciting programs.
From Waterloo?
Yes.
Yes. Yes. Well, thank you. This is a very good answer. Just want to chime in that one key part of entrepreneurs helping us do this stuff cheaper as well as doing it better. It's hard to do both of those at the same time, but those are two very, very much in-demand fields. Bobby, President Katz, would you like to add to that about entrepreneurship?
Go ahead, Bobby.
Go ahead.
You know, I'm struck. I read an article last month about the Peloton bike. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether people have seen that advertisement. And it's a great article. It was written by somebody at Wharton saying that here's the exercise industry taking advantage of what the market wants. And if you think about the Peloton bike, it's a $2,000 bike. You pay $40 a month, and you have access to an array of spinning classes. And not only can you do that, you can track your progress. You can compare yourself to how you're doing with everybody else. It's real time. It's relatively inexpensive. And, you know, think about how higher ed needs to think in that same kind of way. So I agree that a lot of this is going to come out of higher ed, but I think we need to pay more attention to what's going on in industries that aren't necessarily directly higher ed. When you think of the Peloton bike, it's an educational experience. It involves socialization, too.
Mm-hmm. So what would a Peloton University look like?
Peloton University I can pay a fee. I can pull up what I want at a time I want it. Mm-hmm. I can compare how I'm doing with other people who are involved so I can measure my outcome. I can, you know, at some point probably put on my CV or whatever the new way of displaying one's accomplishments, how I did and how I compared to everybody else in my cohort. So I've got my outcome. I show how I rank compared to other people, and I can do it at a pace that I wish. And so, And I can have some social aspects here. You know, it gets rid of the distance and socialization issue. So I think we just got to pay attention to those kind of things. I think those are the kind of things that are out there that are going to happen. I think back, and I'm sure you all do, when the University of Phoenix came out, and you know, people can argue about the quality of that, but that was a game changer.
Yes.
That was a game changer, right? Everybody sort of woke up to what was possible. And I think we've got to pay attention to these other emerging trends that are coming at us and how we adapt accordingly.
Thank you. That's a good answer. Now, I think possibly people here are going to be Googling Peloton bike and running from that. In fact, let's just see if we've gotten any this Learning University accessibility. Actually, we need to come back to this. This is a wow. I think we're outnumbered by the audience at this point. This is an awful lot of material. Well, I'm going to come back to that. Bobby, would you like to take a whack at this entrepreneurship?
I would kind of agree with you in that I think so far we've been in an environment where it's an entrepreneur builds it, and then we either adapt it or we don't adapt it.
Right.
And I think the real movement here is going to come from the presidents and the provosts who are going to say, mm-hmm. we're going to integrate technology across the board. Our job is to optimize the learning environment. And we need something that does this. And then we'll get the answer back from the market. I think you're starting to see that. I think when you're looking at assessments and evaluations of effectiveness in learning, whether it's in med school and you're doing practice, or it's in a classroom kind of environment and you're integrating some sort of a chatbot or an artificial intelligence, or it's in the operating room simulation and you're in some sort of Internet of Thing mannequin or whatever that's collecting the data. I think we have to move through learning analytics to get to learning economics. And learning economics is what is going to be driven by the presidents and the provosts, because that's really what this is all about, creating effective learning that is also cost effective.
Do you think you're assigning the energy to that at the C-suite level, at the provost, dean, and president's level? But earlier, a few minutes ago, you spoke about faculty being relatively retrograde. Is this one area where either faculty governance changes or the institutions that have a serious majority of adjunct faculty are more likely to take the lead?
I think faculty will change and faculty will adapt or faculty will be obsolete. I think you're already seeing that. You're seeing less tenure.
Yeah.
You're seeing more term. I mean, if you look at other than a few of the top 10%,
yeah.
You're seeing in excess of 50% of the faculty being term or adjunct.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's going to continue. I think the attitudes are changing. The attitude used to be that if you were term or if you were adjunct, you weren't as good as.
Mm-hmm.
That's changing.
Yeah.
You know, the people who bring the practical applications and the professional expertise to the classroom are being appreciated more and more and more. So I think that's just a natural evolution that's going to happen.
I think the corollary of that is that just as universities are changing, faculty are going to change.
Yep.
I mean, faculty are now going to be teaching at multiple different, quote, universities.
Mm-hmm.
You know, faculty may have a portfolio of courses and interactive sessions they're doing with a variety of institutions or a variety of students that aren't necessarily housed in what's the traditional space. So I think the faculty will adapt to accordingly. It'll be a different kind of faculty. And I think the adjunct model is a good example of that. How that's not going to be that much of a transition for a lot of faculty now, because they're already doing that.
Okay, thank you. So we began with the question of how will students change by 2030, and now we've advanced to the point where how faculty will change by 2030. Let me just take a quick couple of notes here on what you have added from the audience about where you see entrepreneurship having a big difference. Someone mentioned apprenticeship, which is definitely something that there's a lot of interest in right now. Adding analytics to the LMS, forcing many traditional colleges and universities to close. So this is entrepreneurs not as allies, but as destructive forces.
Bankers talking.
Yeah, I'm sorry?
Those are the bankers talking.
Ah, well, bankers speaking, people do listen. Adaptive learning, and then we had our first mention of open source and free and open source, excellent. And then some really precise ones, too. Third-party generalized lab spaces for basic science and engineering, for example. I think, thank you, buddy. These are terrific comments. There's a lot of ideas here. But since we have the panel, I want to move on a little bit. In case we're not nervous enough, in case we haven't mentioned enough fear and destruction, let me ask you the great question you can ask anybody to shock them and maybe have them say interesting things, which is, which of the educational trends we've discussed keep you up at night?
Is that on the next slide?
It is. Right, there we go. There we go. So which of these trends keep you up? Were you this morning, when I talked this morning?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. So you can just say something that Brian didn't say.
I think probably the one that keeps me up at night the most is the AI,
yeah.
The big data, yeah. The fact that it's coming so fast, that there's so much of it, and that we have so much potential for change. Not only the loss of privacy and identity theft and fake news and fake identity and fake biometrics and fake and fake and fake. I mean, not only that, but the potential we have to influence culture and the world by not getting this right, by not understanding diversity and inclusion as part of this entire ecosphere of data that we're rolling out. I think it's real important that we think about how all of this is going to affect society and everyone in society.
I would say, and for me, though, that comes second after putting on events like this.
I
was going to say that the best way to stop AI is to locate it in a printer, and then no one will ever find it again. I mean, it's a really safe location, or at a hotel Wi-Fi. That'll really take care of someone. I'm sorry.
Now you have another reason why not sleep at night. Thank you very much. But if I could pick up on something you made short reference to in your amazing conversation this morning. Early in my career, a very wise administrator said to me, and I'll never forget this, he said, if you don't know your numbers, you don't know your business. Mm-hmm. So if you're an instructional designer, for example, if you don't know how much time it takes you to construct a course or how much time your students are spending reading the material in the first week, which leads to obviously retention issues, then you don't know your business. If you're a vice president for enrollment and you don't know what it costs for a new student acquisition or what your lifetime value is for a new student, you don't know their business. And for a university leader, I think the pickup when you said I have a little what I call the D formula. The D formula it keeps me up at night is, and I'll tell you what the formula is. It's SD, which is student debt, plus ID, which is institutional debt, plus SD, which is state debt, plus LD, which is, see a pattern here, local debt, plus the national debt equals total debt. If you look at those numbers, just in case you're wondering, it actually has gone up since Brian talked this morning. You're talking $1.5 trillion for student debt, $95 billion in institutions building, lots of buildings. You've got state debt and unfunded health care pension funds at $1.1 trillion. You may mention Illinois. Check out California, or those of us who live in New Jersey. Even local municipalities, more than the state, $1.8 trillion. And then, of course, the national debt at $20.8 trillion. And so what keeps me up at night is things such as the market correcting. Because at the end of the day, it's going to. What keeps me up at night is when local municipalities are coming to small colleges and saying, you know, we can no longer afford to pay for the trash pickup, and for your students living off campus, you're going to have to pay more. And ultimately, the system starting to all come together Teachers, as we saw in West Virginia, walking out for 5 days because they need to have more money. Mm. That's what keeps me up at night. It's the money. It's a debt that you touched on this morning. But until and college leaders that don't understand the impact this has on them and what they can charge for tuition, what they can't charge for tuition now and 10 years from now, I don't think they know their business.
I didn't mention this morning, but you have all contributed another way to the demographic transformation, which is people in their 20s who have substantial academic debt are less likely to start a family. So they're putting off childbirth a little bit. So we're helping change that demographic a little bit. They're also depressing the economy because they're not buying houses as much, again, because of that debt promise. Well, we've mentioned AI and we've mentioned debt, which are two giant, giant trends. President Kess, did you want to add another ticking time bomb for us?
So I'm going to be a little risky here. I think the current political climate is one that's not favorable to higher ed or education in general. And, you know, I'll leave it at that. I think it's a tough time right now. And whether or not it's viewed as valuable, I think there's a lot of questions that people are raising about the value of a college education, which I think are appropriate. I don't see a lot of solutions coming out of that, but that gives me some concern.
As it should. I was just, because I'm a kind of happy, cheerful fellow, I've been rereading Sinclair Lewis's It Can't Happen Here, which is a novel about a hypothetical fascist dictatorship in the U.S. in the 1930s. Anyone else here read it? Yeah, it's a spikes of sales went up last year about that. But one of the things that the dictatorship does is they close a whole bunch of universities and open their own. And so it's actually very funny when you're not crying as you read this. All right, so we have artificial intelligence, debt, and the current political climate. Before we plunge into that, let's just see what people have added. Whoa, people are all over AI. This is in alphabetical order. So I mentioned climate change, yes, and automation in zero jobs. This is low enrollments. And then this is a great point. Oh, this is a subtle point. Higher ed has been tremendously supportive of social and cultural change. As we move away from brick and mortar and traditional liberal arts curricula, what happens to this implicit mission? That's a really good point. Banks and governments running schools, which could be a side effect of your debt bomb. More on this. Colleges sell a lot of useless degrees. What if accreditation or federal law requires job placement data for all colleges and all majors in aggregated normalized format? Yikes. So we go back to the political climate, perhaps, as this goes. This is tremendous stuff. Thank you for everyone who's contributed to this question. If I could, let me just come back to each of you for your tremendous dark trends that you've mentioned. But when it comes back to AI, how do you see academia playing a role? I mean, we make a lot of AI. We do a lot of inventions. And you said, we're often better at this in Silicon Valley. What's the role of at least computer sciences in academia, if not the rest of us?
I think it's the role of computer sciences and the rest of us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think we have to realize that AI is here, AI is accessible, AI is part of everything we do, and we have to get actively involved as educators. We need to do research. We need to do empirical research. We need to show the effects of AI, the positive effects and maybe the not so positive effects. I think it's an active participation in the technology as it rolls out. One of the things that everybody's familiar with is the Gardner curve, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we're at that point in time where we're starting up the curve, mm-hmm. and we're going into la-la land here where it's mm-hmm. going to be, oh, wow, isn't this great? I can do my shopping list. I can watch a video. I could talk to my friend. I can watch a movie. I can order a book. Wait a second. And then let's look at all of the data that's been collected about you, what that says as it's transmitted. You know, one of the apps on facial recognition, Arts and Culture, Google's Arts and
mm-hmm.
Culture,
mm-hmm.
is already biased because of the intelligence that's in there is pretty much white, Caucasian intelligence. So you are going to have a higher percentage. We need to take responsibility for the effects that AI is going to have on us as human beings, whether we're young children or whether we are older people. You know, how is this going to change our culture? How do we make sure that we are not morphing culture in a way that we don't want culture to be morphed? Whether it's male-dominated, female-dominated, white-dominated, whether we're leaving out categories of people or whether we're overemphasizing or underemphasizing things. That's the role higher ed has to play. Mm. And we need to jump in with both feet now.
I think it would be amazing if we could harness some of the energy that goes into building games. You know, they're right at the forefront of all this technology. In fact, I don't know if you know what a GPU is, but it's a graphic processing unit, and they're becoming so valuable because they can't make them fast enough. They're going into machines that that mine for bitcoins and are behind all the AI that's happening. People don't realize that these computer games generate more revenue than Hollywood does. I mean, if they could only shift that into the education realm and keep them away from the dark side, I think we would be in good shape, or better shape.
And to piggyback back on that, I think what we can do right now is more in the realm of adaptive learning. We do have that technology. We do have the vendors. This idea that you put 60 people in a room and everybody comes to that class with the same base knowledge and where they go is obviously way outdated. And we have the ability. We used to do that when we were smaller classrooms prior to World War II. We had these massive, large lectures, and we came in here. So I think there is tremendous possibilities for colleges that want to focus in that area, focus on, because you can do the British model in 3 years and start breaking down this craziness of 120 semester hours, and this is what we need. And the Brits have been doing it for generations, and somehow I don't think we're much smarter than they are. But I think adaptive learning can have an immediate impact on any instructor that wants to go down that path right now and make their classes much more meaningful and using technology in a much different way. You're no longer the sage on the stage, obviously, and you're no longer the subject matter expert in your area. We have a world of subject matter experts. Start using them.
So that's a good answer, or a good first answer. If not both feet, that would be at least a couple of toes in us getting involved. Let me circle back, if I could, to President Katz with a provocative question for you. Up until about 2008, it used to be pretty traditional in the U.S. that education policy was very partisan, that we would have Republicans would say education is too expensive, too labor-intensive, too effete, too communist, and Democrats would say, mais non, it's actually wonderful, we should do all this, and went back and forth. Then about 2008, a few things happened. Teddy Kennedy died and shattered the consensus in the Senate about education. We had the Great Recession, which clobbered state governments as well as universities. And then the Obama administration said, actually, well, education is a mess and we want to fix it. So you had this bipartisan consensus, which is really extraordinary. Yeah. Do you think that bipartisan consensus will continue now, or will we be back to partisan warfare where we have to watch for Republicans wanting to make us better?
Yeah, I think we're past the partisan politics now. I think the public has made it clear that they're not happy with higher ed right now. They're not happy with the cost. They're not happy it takes their kids 6 years to get out of college. They're not happy their kid gets a job. They're not happy that they're paying loans off for the next 5 years. It's clear. And I think that, you know, the academy has been fairly resistant to that, but it's not going away. And I think your point about British education is well taken. That there's obviously nothing magical about the way we do it here. That time element is, I think, is long past the argument stage. So I think we're past that on the partisanship. I think the public understands clearly that things have to change. Look, the one of the things that we've noticed, and some of my colleagues from the university are here, we've noticed that kids have finally figured out you can go to community college for 2 years for a lot cheaper than the four-year university, and then you can transfer, and you probably do every bit as well as the kids that started out there, you know, before 2 years before you. That's just the new reality.
My daughter did that. Yeah.
Right. Well, we're that's one of the reasons where I see my colleague Gloria Pontigia. That's one of the things we're doing with community colleges, because that's part of the new reality. So, yeah, we have informed consumers now, and they're savvy enough to realize that they have a lot of say in what goes on now in higher ed.
And we know it's bad business practice to tell consumers that they are wrong or ill-informed.
Absolutely.
I would add that it is no longer a donkey or elephant issue. They're both are in it. And there was an interesting article, I believe, 2 days ago in the Wall Street Journal about the increased number of kids who are going to career schools. And I think what we can see, again, both donkeys and elephants are supporting this in Washington, is an increased amount of money and attention going to career schools, vocational education, not just the K-12, but higher ed. And we're also seeing, to a lesser extent, kids going into the military as well, and where they had an opportunity to go to an institution like yours, they're sitting down with their mothers and fathers and saying, you know, there's a different route here.
Absolutely.
And I think we're going to see more of that.
Well, that's a really, really good answer. And speaking of time, our panel has been racing along at top speed, and we have about 9 minutes left. What I'd like to do is throw the panel at you and ask you what questions you would like to ask. What questions have come up in our discussion, both as our three panelists have responded and as you've seen here on the screen from GLSR. What questions would you like to put to us about the future of education and technology? All kinds of hands have gone up. You have a beard, but you get to go second because you get to go first. Who are you, first of all?
My name's Nina Nussbaum-Jones. I was a software engineer at Lockheed Martin. Now I do 3D immersive environments.
Awesome.
My question is that all of these questions have no context, and I would like to know how would you contextualize your answers in terms of what the environment is going to be like politically and physically by 2030?
What do you mean by the physical environment?
Well, we're kind of ruining it.
Oh, so you mean the ecosystem?
The ecosystem of life, yes.
Yeah, thank you.
And then the political changes that are really like tectonic plates ripping apart at this point.
Any of those particular political changes you want to draw our attention to? We've already had a few comments about that.
Internationally.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. And by the way, you have awesome jobs. So what do you think, panel? What about the political and environmental context?
I think of the environmental context being, having two or maybe three nor'easters in a row. I mean, this is going to make distance education, online learning, a lot more prevalent and desirable. That certainly is going to be the a big trend going forward, much more than it is now.
That's a good answer.
When it comes, I won't touch on that, but I'll touch a little bit on the political cultural side, I guess. Having been being the son of a Holocaust survivor, I've kind of studied this issue quite a bit, and I think it's safe to say that some of the risks that we're seeing in across the globe, particularly in Europe, and the nationalism we're seeing in these countries, as well as our own, is very historically scary, in large part because it is being orchestrated and funded. How that all plays out 15, 20 years from now, even 5 years from now, gosh, if you knew that, you could be very wealthy. But it is, I agree with you, it is very scary to watch from a historical perspective because in some respects it looks like 1930s all over again. And I hope at least as a nation we can stop eating each other that we seem to be likely to do these days and lead, because it doesn't seem that way in other parts of the world. And education, again, could be that, it should be that place that people can have these conversations about differences and similarities and lead. But I think we all agree we've seen campuses where that is being challenged. So
the Italian election outcomes would be one more data point for you.
Not sure. I'm not sure if it's...
Well, that was the election outcome. Not sure. That was...
Yeah.
But the right wing did very, very well.
Yeah.
Bobby, would you like to add?
I think you're going to see... I'm going to be the positive person here. I think you're going to see huge changes, and I think we're going to go through huge changes in consciousness first that will lead to those huge changes in terms of environment and politics. I don't think there's any question in anybody's mind that climate change is real. I mean, maybe two people are proclaiming it, but I don't think they really believe it either. You know, I don't think that there's any question in anybody's mind that from a learning standpoint, from a how we treat each other standpoint, from a we just can't, you know, from a political standpoint, I mean, we're going to just keep banging our... Now, there might be some, you know, some nasty bangs against the wall here. But I do think that, you know, when we embarked upon the Internet, it was one of the great social greatest social experiments ever undertaken.
Mm-hmm.
And where that leads is probably not going to be painless. But I do think by 2030, we will be in a better place collectively as a planet, as a people, and, you know, in terms of being well-educated than we are now.
Thank you. Those are fantastic answers. And thank you very much for a very rich question. Thank you. I really appreciate that. I think we have time for one more question. Yeah, please.
I just wanted to follow up on something a keynote said earlier in this morning. If we're looking at a future where AI is adding to automation and less work for humans and a lot of leisure time, does this mean our higher education system has to educate people in a different way? Is it a return to maybe getting away from the trade-based jobs, but a return to traditional classic liberal arts where we're thinking about what is a meaningful life and then how do we live that in an age of automation?
Who are you and where are you from?
My name is Nick. I'm an instructional designer at LaSalle. Hi, Bobby.
Thank you for the good question. Please. Go ahead.
I'll try to do that one. I mean, I don't think we have any kind of idea how much and how fast entire industries are going to be changed. I was telling Doug that one of the things that came up when I was at the symposium was that the insurance industry, everybody's talking about self-driving cars and how it's going to affect the trucking industry. Well, it's also going to wipe out the auto insurance industry. And, I mean, those are a lot of jobs that are going to be lost really quickly that probably aren't coming back in forms of another insurance job. You know, so... again, you know, I personally believe that it's not a leisure or work. I think everybody needs meaningful work.
Mm-hmm.
How do you define that meaningful work, and what is that meaningful work? Maybe meaningful work is replaced by you being able to help another human being, or you being able to tutor someone, or you being able to be an aid to somebody, or whatever it is. And, you know, it's not a question of we're going from work to leisure. I think we're going from work to looking at how we can help each other and how we can work for each other through a very different lens.
Would that be an example of the consciousness transformation you were anticipating?
Yeah.
Good. That's a beautiful answer. Thank you. Gentlemen, Paul?
I think more right-brainedness is a good thing. And I think we all need to do that. And we struggle with where we find time in our curricula to allow right brain thinking. But I think the at least some of you in the audience will remember a time when there were actually three people in the front of a commercial airliner. There was somebody called the navigator who walked on with a big black container full of maps, and they're gone now. So I think right now it's about developing competencies and lifelong learning because these jobs are going to evolve. I mean, we have a very large pharmacy school, and we're having a lot of discussion about what's the pharmacist of the future.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's he or she going to do? What's that industry going to look like? And since we don't know, what are the skills and attributes that we need to embed in our students to allow them to adapt to those changes? So I think it's going to be a lot less about memorization and a lot more about developing skills and competencies that will evolve over time.
I would just add that I think, and this may be a popular thing to see at a technology-related event, but I think, and I've always felt, that it's as important to know when not to use technology as it is to when to use technology. And I think sometimes there's an over-reliance on that. And I think one thing that's probably not going to change in the next 20 years is that young men and women are still going to want to be in a room and they're going to have their phones. I get it, but there's still going to be that human interaction that's going to be necessary. There's still going to be need to be critical readers and critical thinkers and reason inductively. Mm-hmm. I think ultimately the winning combination for a college that you suggested is to stop this isolated way in which we teach the humanities. So it's more or less just a connection, almost like a Chinese menu. You take this, you take that. There's no connection between history and writing and philosophy and religion. And as I think you're alluding to, what we will see is problems becoming much more complex, and those skills that they may not be getting in philosophy and religion and economics, all are necessary to solve these very difficult problems, not just technology. I think some college is going to come up there and have a really meaningful, connected experience, and that college will be throwing kids out. They'll have more kids lining up than they know what to do with.
So we start with a question of underemployment, and we end with answers about meaning and what humans do well with each other. Thank you for that terrific question. Thank you for those great answers. And if I could, let me thank the panel. And can you help me thank the panel? Wonderful people. And let me thank you as well for these great questions and also for this steady flow of comments displayed via Glisser. Thank you all.
Let's thank Brian. Have you ever seen a better moderator?
Maybe that will work. This is easy.
So that's it for today. I hope you enjoyed this panel discussion. I think it gives you a lot of food for thought and how future education is going to roll out. Until next time, have a great week.
That's it for today's episode. Thank you very much for listening. Don't forget to give Rod feedback. You can leave comments on his blog or send email to rod@rodspulsepodcast.com. The preceding audio commentary is the product of the author, Dr. Rodney Murray, and does not represent the official viewpoint of the University of the Sciences or any other institution or company.